This is Sports Jam. I'm Doug Doyle. Recently, another induction ceremony taking place at the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, New York. And also an opportunity to talk about a new novel that's based in Cooperstown. My guest on Sports Jam is author and longtime journalist Mark Diano.
Take me out to the ball game. Take me out to the crowd. Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jacks. I don't care if I never get back. Let me root, root, root for the home team. If they don't win, it's a shame. For it's 1, 2, 3 strikes, you're out at the old ball game.
The name Mark Diano is familiar to many of us because not only is he a lifelong journalist and Pulitzer Prize finalist from New Jersey, but many of you have read his front page columns for the Star Ledger and NJ.com. Some of you might not know that Mark began his career as a sports writer for the New York Post. Sports provides the backdrop for his second novel that has just come out, Gods of Wood and Stone, published by Touchstone. Mark, thanks for coming in to WBGO to talk about your latest work.
Thanks, Doug. I'm glad to be here.
The two main characters that you created in Gods of Wood and Stone are very different in many ways. You have a blacksmith named Horace Mueller who lives in Cooperstown, New York, and you have a former Boston Red Sox player, Joe Grudek. Why did you come up with these two individuals?
Well, it's interesting because for me, this book is almost like a marriage of both of my careers as a sports columnist and then as a general news columnist. As a general news columnist, I started to discover New Jersey's history, and I got deeply immersed in it. And I met guys like Horace Mueller, these, you know, reenactors and these people that are very passionate about history. You know, they dress up and they have Canal Day up at Waterloo Village and you know, Revolutionary War enactors and Civil War enactors. And so for me, there's two reasons I picked the blacksmith. One is that the blacksmith used to be the embodiment of masculinity in the 19th century, in the 17th century, you know, the Wadsworth poem, you know, about the blacksmith. The blacksmith is the guy, he was the strong man of the village. He was the guy that could bend metal and do miraculous things. He worked in fire. And obviously the role model for masculinity in our culture is the athlete. And so putting those two guys at the ends of those historical perspective was interesting to me. And the other thing is that, you know, the blacksmith basically works in the dark. You know, he works in a dark place lit by the fire. You know, in the old days, it was, you weren't in the light. You had to be inside, where the coal fire would go. And the ball player works in the light. And so that darkness versus light and those, you know, being on different ends of the popular culture spectrum was interesting to me. You know, one of the themes that through the book is that the Farm Museum and the Hall of Fame come under the same umbrella in Cooperstown. They're run by the same foundation. And of course, all the money, all the attention goes to the Hall of Fame, and the Farm Museum, you know, gets many, many, many thousands of less visitors, if they even get, you know, a couple thousand a year. And so there's the blacksmith, you know, working in obscurity, and he has this, you know, jealousy and anger that the culture has shifted towards sports and nobody really cares about the rural roots of the country and the foundation of the country anymore.
I'm going to ask you to give us just a little synopsis because we don't want to give away everything that happens, but what would you like the listeners to know as you summarize the plot of the book?
Well, the book begins, the opening of the book is the blacksmith jumps up on the stage during Joe Grudek's induction, and he breaks up his plaque with a hammer. And Joe Grudek has absolutely no idea who this guy is. He doesn't know who this guy is. He thinks it might have something to do with a Me Too moment way, way, way back in his minor league playing days. And he's afraid of that. He's afraid that that incident will pop his, you know, his image bubble. And the blacksmith, you know, and then they have a fight. And Joe Grudek, who's a big guy, and you know, they even made a base brawl video of him because he was, you know, always jumping into the fray. He has his hands full with this guy. He's a strong working man. And when they're separated, Joe Grudek is injured. And then the next chapter opens up with Horace Mueller waking up in his farmhouse. And you realize that it's prior to this. And the whole book works back to the confrontation. And in the process, we learn that Horace is alienated from his wife because he's trying to pull his son back from the sports and pop culture juggernaut. He wants his son to learn more about their authentic culture, teach him things about, you know, geology and the stars and all those kind of stuff that boys don't learn anymore because they're just on travel teams and, you know, their parents are their caddies. And Horace Mueller really resents this. He resents that he's losing this battle, and it causes tremendous strain in his marriage. The Joe Grudek's narrative is about the alienation of celebrity. And this is, I think, a really important American topic. Celebrities become cartoon characters to us, or just they're just we care about them for what they are, not who they are. And so at the end of his career, now that he's going into the Hall of Fame, he realizes all he is to people is who he was, not who he is. And this is terrifying to him. You know, he knows he's going to be the guy that, you know, when they come to a card show, they'll look at him and they'll say, hey, what the hell happened to Joe Grudek? He looks so old, you know, because in people's minds, he's still the young ball player. And he is adrift in the world. He's never made friendships, close friendships. He never married. He took advantage of his celebrity in that way. And now that he is retired and he's working, he's living at a golf course based on Trump National. And believe me, I started this book long before Donald Trump became president. He's working at a golf club there, rounding out foursomes with, you know, really rich executives and, you know, country club members, which is so contrary to his upbringing, where his father was a sheet metal fabricator in a union. So these two guys are like lost in their own worlds. And you said earlier, Doug, that they were very different, but in some ways they're also very, very similar. They're throwbacks to an age that they thought was simpler, more pure, and they're disgusted by the world that they live in now. And so that the trajectory of the story, Horace's anger fuels his narrative. And Joe Grudek's anger and alienation fuels his narrative. And so he decides that he wants his induction speech to be about how sports got out of control in his lifetime. And just as he's about to deliver the speech, that's when the blacksmith comes up
and never gets to do a speech.
He never gets to do the speech. And so one of the great ironies of the book is this guy with the great historic intent, which is the blacksmith, wrecks the historic moment that for the ball player who's essentially going to do the same thing that the blacksmith does. Hey, let's remember how it used to be.
How did the shoe-in Hall of Famer Joe Grudek pop into your mind?
Well, when I was a young sports writer in, you know, the early 1980s and all through the 80s to the 90s, There were a bunch of guys like Jack Youngblood from the Rams and Carlton Fisk from the Red Sox that were sort of the last of the generation of ball players that weren't making, you know, $30 million a year. Carlton Fisk, for instance, had to serve 2 years in the National Guard in 1968 before he could play Major League Baseball. And there was this great scene, I remember, at Yankee Stadium where Carlton Fisk and Deion Sanders got into a confrontation. Deion Sanders, you know, chained up, earrings, $1 million signing bonuses for the Yankees and the Cowboys, I think, at that time, or Raiders, I forget who. He popped up and ran right into the dugout. And I guess the next time he came up, Carlton Fisk said something like, hey, Rook, we run him out in this league. You know, typical, you know, busting the chops of a rookie. Sanders, I think the story went, I saw it, spit a wad of tobacco juice across the plate and in response, and Fisk got up and was right in his face. And I wrote a column about that because for me, it was this great change of the guard, you know. And so Joe Grudek, the catcher, is in terms of his playing career, is based on Carlton Fisk, you know, and his playing career. The personal stuff about Joe Grudek, his alienation and loneliness when he retires, I don't know Carlton Fisk at all. I don't know anything about him. So that part of Joe Grudek's character is not based on anyone except maybe myself.
Horace hates the digital age and resents that his son Michael would rather play and watch games on his big screen, TV, and whatnot, rather than work in the shop with him, and as you mentioned, would rather be playing sports. Do you draw that from anything inside you, that you hate what has happened with the family structure, with the digital age? Is there any of Mark Diano in there?
Well, sure. I mean, I have six children, and all of them played sports to some degree. So I have spent a lot of my life, you know, sitting on aluminum bleachers, you know, driving to, you know, on Mother's Day to take a kid to a travel team soccer game. And, you know, and I began to realize, like, my children's childhoods are very much different from mine. When I was a kid, this before Route 78 was built, we could walk from the mountain in Summit and go down into the Watchung Reservation, and we would explore the deserted village there. And there was a Nike missile base, the old Nike missile base we went into, and the stables were down there. And, you know, this is how we spent a part of our weekends and our time off. And, you know, you went out the door at 8 o'clock and you didn't come home till dinner time. And as a parent, I realized that what we, many of us, have become are, you know, caddies for our kids. And I remember just looking at one of the soccer fields where my kids grew up and looking at all these children, little children, running around playing soccer and at least 500 parents there. And I'm thinking to myself, if these people all gave this hour and a half to Habitat for Humanity, they could build a house. You know, like, all this adult time is kind of being, you know, wasted. You know, you're enjoying watching your kids, but you lose a sense of your own life. And I think that's really what's happened to my generation of parents and younger, is that you don't, your children don't have a sense that you have an adult life, that you have adult hobbies, that you can teach them things about the world around them. When I go to historic sites like Washington headquarters and places like that, you don't see families anymore. You know, they're not out. They're not learning. You know, I live in a Morris County town, and I went in and talked to the kids about the American Revolution. You know, how many of you have been to Washington headquarters? You know, one kid raises his hand, you know, and that's a shame that they don't understand their surroundings.
What's been the most interesting comment one of your kids has given you about your novels?
Oh, boy. My sons, really identify with this book. They see a lot of it, and they really appreciate the book. The book is definitely a masculine book. I think my youngest son sort of recognizes that there's a part of Joe Grudek and a part of Horace Mueller and me, that, you know, there's in me, there's this, you know, arc of trying to teach my children about the world around them, this kind of discomfort with how interested in sports they were. And by the way, they're moving away from that. You know, now they're in their early 20s. There's the saturation limit has happened, and they're not as interested as they used to be. And I think that they see that in me, and so they've talked about that. I can't really come up with one single thing that they said, except that, you know, they both, those boys, just really love the book, and I think they recognize how hard I worked on it, how long I worked on it, and how much it's about their lives as well as mine.
There's a man at my house, he's so big and strong. He goes to work each day and he stays all day long. He comes home each night looking tired and beat. He sits down at the dinner table and has a bite to eat. Never a frown, always a smile.
Mark Diano is our guest here on Sports Jam. His new novel, Gods of Wood and Stone, published by Touchstone. It did take you 14 years to eventually get this done, but there's, I think it's so relevant right now because you mentioned one of the secrets dealing with the Me Too movement, as you refer to it, is always on the back burner and back in the mind of Joe Grudek. So maybe it was a good thing that you waited.
Well, you know, everything in God's time, right? God's will, God's time. The other aspect of the book, in addition to the Me Too stuff, is that, you know, Horace Mueller sort of stands for, I don't want to say the Trump voter, because that's not exactly right, but he stands for that sort of middle-aged guy, white guy, or just guy in general. I think a lot of African-American men and Hispanic men feel this way too. They just feel that their values have slipped through their fingers. You know, like the values that they wanted to impart their children to as family men has slipped through their fingers because the pop culture forces are just too great. And, you know, I mean, you know, I don't want to sound like a curmudgeon, but when I was a kid, you know, we had weekend shows, cartoons and stuff. Now these kids have five or six stations aimed at them 24/7, you know, aimed at the commercialism, aimed at, you know, for them to buy products, for them to, we elevate, you know, these Disney children that are become pop stars. And so, you know, the Disney Channel especially irks me because the message is, if you're not in entertainment, you're nobody. You know, all the kids, all the teenage stars are people that are singers or something else. And I think a lot of men feel that way. A lot of men feel that they're not able to raise their children the way they want to because of these influences. And then the second thing I think that a lot of men feel is when you have children, you know, the bond between mother and child leaves you on the outside looking in at times, and a certain anger percolates over that. And certainly in Horace Mueller's case, that's the case. He is trying to do things with his son, and his wife is saying, leave him alone, let him do what he wants. Why don't you want him to be happy? And Horace Mueller's outlook is, well, life isn't about that. It's about learning. It's about other things. And, you know, I've certainly wrestled with that, you know, in my own family of three boys and three girls, you know, just, hey, you know, I want you to do this and learn this. And the kids are just pulled in a different direction.
When we say that it took you 14 years to complete, people might not understand. They'll say, wow, you have done so many things in between here that obviously you've been an extremely busy writer, both on the news side and the sports side, as well as now as a novelist. What do you like better?
Well, this is my second novel. My first novel was called The Last Newspaper Man, and that was really a story about the changes of media. And it's about fake news. It came out in 2012, long before Donald Trump coined that expression. The book, The Last Newspaper Man, is about a 1930s tabloid journalist who basically made stuff up. The book centers around the Lindbergh baby kidnapping and the crash of the Hindenburg and the fire on the Morrow Castle, and the landing of the Martians in Grover's Mill, which is the absolute epitome of fake news. And that book, it all takes place in New Jersey for a reason, because all those stories happened in New Jersey, and a reporter would have covered all those things in a 10-year career. And so this guy, he's a guy who at times he makes things up, and at other times his bosses tell him what to write and make things up. One of the examples is the Hearst newspapers. Randolph Hearst was a German admirer. I wouldn't say a Nazi supporter, but he admired the Germans. And he took payments from the Hitler regime to write positive stories about Germany. And so when the Hindenburg crashed, it was obviously an industrial nightmare for the Germans. This was their big ship. And the Hearst newspapers put out that it was shot down by Zionists in the early going. And this reporter, whose name is Fred Haynes, is on the scene, and everyone's talking about the explosion and electrical current, and nobody mentions Nazi Zionists Nazi-hating Zionists. And the next day, his story comes out, and it's about people saying that Zionists shot it down. And so this whole sense of where the media began to turn into something that became crime and celebrity ridden begins with the Lindbergh baby kidnapping. And again, I felt that book was really prescient because it came out 6 years ago. And in that book, it's predicted that the media is going to hit a crisis of validity, a crisis of trust, because the digital age is making it too easy to not read in-depth stories.
When you're doing these novels, you can let loose a little bit, right?
Sure. I think that's a great thing. And, the column is 1,000 words, 750 words, and it's a lot. And I write two or three a week. I write 100,000 inches, or I mean 100,000 pages a year, but I think the novel allows me to go into deeper aspects of what I think is the truth and aspects of my personality, a knowledge of a greater breadth of history and understanding than I can do in the paper, story by story. I think if you look at the body of work, I'm the same guy that's the novelist. I think the body of work stands for some of the same things I stand for as a novelist. Again, Doug, I didn't answer your question, which do I think is more fun, which do I like? I like better. And, I'm 61 years old. I've been a journalist for 40 years, and it would be nice to be able to sort of get into a rhythm where I can write fiction at a faster rate. And by the way, I started this book 14 years ago, and then wrote The Last Newspaper Man in between. So the books were being done simultaneously. Now, one thing that's important is, though, that you know, my life as a journalist feeds the novels, you know, and, you know, I think so many books today are, you know, self-introspective and only talk about one person's journey or where they fit into the American landscape. And I think as a journalist, I get to see those different players in the big landscape and can sort of take a step back. And while I put myself in the book, certainly these two books, my first two novels, are really about the country. And as an example of my journalism leading to novels, I'm working on a book now about police PTSD. And it's about a homicide detective who is dramatically changed by the amount of violence he sees. And the book is about violence in America, you know, and the fact that violence in our country is going to touch us all. At some point, violence in this country is going to touch all of us.
We're speaking with Mark Diano, who's out with his new novel, Gods of Wood and Stone, published by Touchstone. Now, the fact that much of this book is centered in Cooperstown, New York, where the Baseball Hall of Fame is, how much time have you spent there, and where did you draw from some of these places and signs and things that you talk about in the book?
Well, let me start by saying, if in a perfect world, the baseball player would have been a football player. Because I think football is much more a sport that has so many negative connotations and has changed so dramatically and is, you know, has this tremendous, you know, fan base and the violence of it, you know, I remember even my dad saying it's like the Roman gladiators. And I think that football players, more than baseball players, are just pieces of meat to people, you know. And they don't care about the steroids. They don't care about the crime. They don't care about the bad behavior. As long as they're out there killing each other, that's entertainment. But unfortunately, there's not a farm museum in Canton. So, you know, in order to bring the blacksmith into the athlete realm, it had to be set in Cooperstown. And so, you know, I spent a lot of time up there, and I think I captured very much the there's the two characters. There's two characteristics of Cooperstown. It used to be called the Village of Museums, and it was, you know, it celebrated its Victorian architecture and mid 19th century Federalist architecture. And, you know, there's all these, you know, kind of quaint bed and breakfasts and all that. And then the downtown is card shops, memorabilia shops, you know, everything, you know, T-shirts. It's like as I don't want to say cheesy, but it is all based on baseball. And the other charm of the city kind of gets lost in that. People don't go to Cooperstown to visit the farm museum. Senior citizen bus tours may go, but not, you know, I don't pack up my six kids and say, hey, let's go to Cooperstown to go to the farm museum. So it's all about baseball, baseball, baseball. And of course, as Jerseyans, we all know that that's, that's fictitious too, that the first baseball game was actually played right here in Hoboken rather than Cooperstown, but they own that history. So, and they've done something with it. So I think that's why I set it there. And I spent enough time there to get the feel of the place. I think the scene where Joe Grudek is in the bat store and he's signing the bats is a very realistic scene. I think Horace's aggravation that his son chooses to work in that bat store rather than have a summer internship at the Farm Museum is a very real clash of a father's mentality about trying to guide his son into something different.
One thing about Horace is when Horace Mueller refers to induction week at Cooperstown as dysfunction week.
Yeah,
I like how
yeah.
you phrase that.
Yeah. This is the week that the tourists come, and certainly, you know, when you have a Boston Red Sox or a Yankee coming in, it changes the character of the town even more so, because it's driving distance and it's packed, and let's face it, those fans aren't always on their best behavior.
Did you have a sports idol growing up?
Carlos Monzon. Carlos Monzon was the middleweight champion from Argentina.
The referee is Piero Brambilla of Italy, and he is a good one. I have seen him work often. The bell for round one, Griffith in the blue trunks, the black fighter, and Monzon, the white fighter in the black trunks.
Legendary sportscaster Howard Cosell had the call in 1973 from Monte Carlo, Monaco.
Those of you who have seen Monzon fight know that he is a tough, mauling, brawling style of fighter who uses the left jab and then comes in with a whistling right. He's never been knocked out, a very difficult opponent who uses the arms, the elbows, the shoulders. Griffith, lacking the reach of Monzon, will have to get inside and work on the midsection and hope in that manner to wear Monzon down. It will not be easy. Apparently, Carlos Monzon has been given the decision and is still the middleweight champion of the world.
I just love the way he fought. He was a big, tall guy, and he'd just stand there in the pocket with guys that were much more powerful punchers and just pick them off. And he was an interesting cat. He became an action star in Argentina. And then, like many fighters, I think the damage to their brains leads them to very bad things. And he ended up throwing his wife off a balcony. Then he was in prison. And he got out of prison on a furlough and drove a car off a cliff and died. So, you know, just a typical boxing tragic story. But as a kid, I really liked Carlos Monzon.
Two questions about your past. When was the first time you wrote something that you knew you were pretty good at it?
I had a teacher in high school named Mr. Holman who told me he thought I had some talent as a writer. And that really fueled me. And I read a book called The Temple of Gold by William Goldman that was really a book that made me think, you know, I could do this. You know, I can write this kind of story. And so right from a very early age, I wanted to be a writer. It just struck me as a good way to feed my ego, you know, pontificate about my ideas and life and all that other arrogant stuff that, you know, that people like me put on the table at times. I became a journalist in the Navy, and right away, you know, yeah, I did have a talent for the storytelling and the ability to write. And our little hospital newspaper, which was a one-man operation, won a Navy-wide award for journalism excellence, whatever that was. And boy, I was on my way. I said, this is cloud nine. And when I came out of the Navy, I went right to work, right to college, but I also went right to work at the Morristown Daily Record. And I was in news for a brief period and then sports. And I was on my way. And by the time, you know, at 33, by the time I could take a breath and say, is this really what I want to do? I was a columnist in New York City. And so, like, well, I guess this is it. You know, I never really explored another option. And so, and here we are.
You mentioned that all your kids played sports. What sports did you play?
I was a wrestler, which, you know, explains why Carlos Monzon was my sports idol, because
Were you good?
I was all right. Yeah, not anything. I didn't put enough time into it. I was okay. I wish I had put more into it in my life. But I still stay close to it. I enjoy watching it, and I coached it for years too, as you know, in my town. So I've always been drawn to sort of the one-on-one sport more so than the team sport. It's too bad that that amateur wrestling takes a back seat to so many other sports in this country, because it really is a tremendous test of character and will, individuality.
You've covered a lot of sporting events throughout your career. If you could go back in time, and a time that you missed, what event would you like to go back and see and report on?
Well, I think the most exciting thing I ever saw was the Tyson Spinks fight. The electricity of that fight was just unbelievable, and it was I think everybody in that place felt like they were about to fight themselves. But the event that I really had the most fun covering, I think, well, I always had a lot of fun covering boxing. I did a lot of boxing, and I liked it. I felt really entrenched in the community of boxing, which was very New York centric in those days, and Las Vegas and New York centric. But the event that I really enjoyed covering the most in terms of access to the athletes and fun was the Meadowlands Grand Prix. I mean, I just used to love that. You know, I was in a trailer with Mario Andretti after he got bumped out of the race, and he's taking off his racing suit, and the guy's standing there in his underwear, complaining about what happened. And Emerson Fittipaldi, I'm walking back across the, walking to the place where he crashed or something, and he's walking back and he's waiting to Al Unser Jr. to come around again and wave his fist at him, and I'm there, with the guy. So that kind of access, I'm sure it's not like that in racing now, but in those days, that was a lot of fun. I enjoyed that very much.
You mentioned two former guests on Sports Jam, Mike Tyson and Mario Andretti, both very interesting interviews.
Sure.
With those individuals. We're speaking with Mark Diano. Pulitzer Prize, or some people say Pulitzer Prize finalists, what did that mean to you?
Well, I work for the North Star Ledger, and I'm not a very liberal voice. I'm apolitical, really. I stay away from politics. I just don't like it. And there's enough people who write about politics. We don't need another blank opinion on Donald Trump or Governor Christie or whatever. So I always wanted to be more of a human interest column and tell stories that people could identify with. They could see themselves in the paper, So for that reason, I thought I'll never win a Pulitzer. I'll never get close to a Pulitzer because, it's just I'm not Pulitzer material. And so when I became a finalist for the Sandy coverage, I felt it was more the hurricane than me. Although I did a good job, and I was pretty much immersed in the storm and the aftermath. Three of the columns that were submitted for the Pulitzer were written on an iPhone outside of a Wawa in Toms River, which is the only place where there was electricity and food and. And we had, we could email the columns in. So it was a very exciting time, a very, very tragic and sad time, and a time of great, of great perseverance and human fight. One of the Pulitzer columns was about the Gelhaus family that owns the Keensburg Boardwalk. And how this is like the fourth hurricane in their 100-year history that has destroyed the place, and all they were going to do is rebuild. And the day of the day after the hurricane, one of the Gelhaus brothers said to me, "We'll be open by Easter." And sure enough, they were.
Keensburg Amusement Park was right across the bay from my place. I was displaced from my apartment in Union Beach, and I remember covering the story for NPR, talking about my own place.
Sure.
You know, so I know what a difficult time that was to be covering that story.
When I drove down there, I was one of the first, I think the first reporter in Union Beach. When I drove down there, I thought to myself, this is no hurricane. This had to be tornadoes mixed in with this. This was a tsunami. This was a tidal wave. This was, and we heard that from up and down the coast. It was one wave, you know, one giant wave. A guy in Sayreville told me it was a 30-foot wave. The police chief in Seaside Heights was in one of those armored vehicles, those big national defense trucks. The wave came in and knocked that truck into a wall. He thought he was going to die. So we heard this over and over. One guy said to us, how long do you think the water was up? And I said, I don't know. This is like day after the storm. I said, what, like a couple hours? He goes, 20 minutes. Went in and went out. And Brook Avenue was evidence of that. Like the Brook Avenue beach looked like the town yard sale. I mean, everything was, you know, refrigerators, hot water heaters, you know, everything's out there. And the neighborhood looked like a bomb hit it. You know, everybody say, oh, it looks like a war zone, blah, blah, blah. This looked like a war zone. I mean, this looked like a bomb hit it. And, you know, there's a roof to a house sitting in the middle of a street three blocks from the house. You know, crazy stuff. So I covered all that. And then I went, you know, I think almost like war catastrophe has a, it becomes like, you become addicted to it. Like I could not tear myself away from that story. I think I worked like 30 or 40 days in a row, just going back. And I live in Morris County. I'd go home and go back, go home and go back. And when I got to Union Beach another time, they had let the people in. And I'll never forget this, Doug, as long as I live. And I get choked up even when I talk about it now. On Brook Avenue, there was a series of, and other places, there was a series of brick stoops. And that was all that was left of these people's houses. And the people had been in the area rummaging through their stuff. And on those brick stoops, they put things like their cat collection of cat sculptures or their children's trophies. One stoop had a bunch of dolls. And I thought to myself, this they're just saying, you know, we lived here. This is where we lived. This is who we were. And man, I sat down on one of those stoops. I just could not stop myself from crying. I'm, you know, your listeners can't see it, but I'm getting choked up as I remember that now. And I just remember saying to Andy Mills, who's one of our great photographers. He did so much great work. We worked together on that. He did all the aerial shots of the destruction, and those took your breath away. You know, just to see the swath of destruction. But for me, it was when you looked at the ground at your feet where you saw the wedding albums, you know, the children's toys, the certificates, the graduation certificates. That to me was like, this is where you saw that it was individual people, people's lives, you know, and you experience it, you know, just taken away by this thing.
You can hear, and as you mentioned, the emotion inside Mark Diano, and you can feel it in his new novel, as the new novel is Gods of Wood and Stone, published by Touchstone. And I'd like you to read an excerpt of the book, if you would, for us, Mark, that I had actually singled out to you before we started this interview, because I think it captures your writing, it captures your love of history of this, the Garden State, mentioning some areas, and also you take us inside the mind of your characters, if you would.
Sure. I never really like to read because as I'm reading, I always think about how I could have written it better.
I understand that.
But here goes. Grudek headed west instead of east on Route 78 and took the long way up to Cooperstown, heading out Route 80 into the West Jersey sunset, up I-81 through the moon-silhouetted endless mountains of northeastern PA, and then back east across I-88 to Cooperstown. The drive reminded him of his trips from Union to Fort Myers for spring training. He shut off the interior lights and killed the music to immerse himself in the black and quiet cockpit, with only the droning, muted road noise as a baseline for his thoughts. It was a smaller space, a moving capsule, in which to feel less lonely and less anxious about the speech. Unlike those trips, he stayed in the right lane, keeping within the speed limit, not blasting through the night at triple digits. He was in no hurry to get there, the opposite, in fact. Somewhere near Clark Summit, Pennsylvania, this thought occurred to him. All those 24-hour races down south were part of his long journey to Cooperstown, and now here he was making the final leg to baseball immortality, whatever that meant. He suddenly grew afraid of the return trip home, still alone, beginning the second half of his life on the road to irrelevance. An old-timer getting older year after year, and maybe not such a popular one if he delivered his speech. Can I read the next couple graphs?
Absolutely.
He pulled off for gas, and the Access and Convenience Store parking lot was busy with teenagers, boys and girls together, sitting in and on cars with naked arms all over each other on this warm July night. He moved through them to get a Coke, unrecognized, just another solo stranger on the road through their town, soon to disappear in the dark. At the junction of I-81 and I-88, the overhead signs told of the coming split, Syracuse to the left, Cooperstown to the right. He thought of the girls back at the highway stop, just kids, small-town girls, bored with their high school boys and their big talk of dreams they all knew would never come true. Girls who might want to have some fun with a guy they thought had even a little chance to be famous, like a minor league ball player. Grudek looked himself in the rearview mirror. Oncoming headlights illuminated only his tired eyes, equally scared of a past he could not change and a future he could not grasp. Joe, asshole, you deserve what you get. So those last two paragraphs speak to this Me Too moment that he's afraid of, that, you know, in this past sin, you know, these young kids remind him he was just a kid, and these girls that came to the minor league ballpark were these kind of girls from the middle of nowhere, you know, girls that would probably just end up like their mothers, and they want to, you know, meet a guy who might be going somewhere. And he ends up in a situation, a Me Too situation, with the girls. And so on this trip to Cooperstown, the weight of his life, the weight of his past, and the weight of his future is all on him. And I just love that line in there about, you know, being in the cockpit and, you know, just being lonely in a smaller space, you know. You know, you're loneliest when you're in New York City. If you go home and you put yourself in a closet, you don't feel as lonely, right? And I think that I'm glad you picked those paragraphs for me to read, Doug. They're really telling. Thank you.
Well, thanks for sharing that with us. We appreciate that here on Sports Jam. You know, I also love the fact that in your book, you intertwine your characters with real life characters as you go. You even mentioned the former Pittsburgh Pirate Richie Zisk, and I was like, wow, there it is. He was one of my favorite players.
He was from Union, I think. That's why he was in there, because Union produced a number of ball players. But Joe Grudek, the fictional Joe Grudek, he was the biggest of them all.
Biggest of them all. What has been, I know we got your response from your children, but what has been the comment from someone who has read your book that means the most to you, that really tells you that, hey, all this 14 years of thinking about it, and, you know, obviously you weren't working on it all the time, but it's really been worth the effort?
The acquisition editor of this book is a guy named David Falk, who was at Touchstone, and now he's going to be the director of development for Yaddo, which is an artist colony in Saratoga. Big, it's a big deal. It's like a big artist writers colony, and it's very historic. and anybody you can think of as a writer has been through it. David believed in this book, and you know, my agent said, nobody's going to want to read a book about middle-aged white guys. And I said, well, you know, maybe if we put out books for middle-aged white guys, they'd read them. You know, literary fiction. David recognized the power of the book right away. And what he said to me that was just such a great compliment in such a sad way is that the opening chapter, the chapter where Horace, you're introduced to Horace, after the confrontation, he said was the greatest scene of marital discord he had ever read. And this guy has been an editor and read, you know, thousands of books. And the other thing that happened just the last couple days was I got an email from the man named LJ Ganser, who is reading the book. He's doing the Audible version of the book. And again, a guy who's read thousands of books, and he just said this book, just he's so immersed in it. He loved the dialogue. He loved the internal thoughts of the characters. He said it was just, you know, he very rarely, you know, it's a job for him. He very rarely loves a book that he's reading. He doesn't choose what he can read. And this book really moved him. And just this morning, he sent me an email that said, I'm going to miss Horace and Joe Grudek. And to me, that's like the whole thing. Like, you know, I felt the same way. Like, you know, I finished the book and these two guys, like my friends, where are they going? It's like they moved away, you know? And I think that's a great compliment. If you feel that the people are so real that, you know, that you can touch them. They're real human beings. They're not guys blowing up buildings. They're not CIA agents. They're not, you know, they're not superstars. You know, they're real human people. And at the end of the book, and I know I have felt this about every book I have ever loved, I didn't want it to end. I didn't want to let that guy just go. And so the question is, will there be a sequel to this book? And
you just took the words right out of my mouth.
And the answer is probably not. You know, John Updike did that with the Rabbit books. Harry Angstrom was the character. I don't think so. I think for me, it's time to move on to something else. You know, Doug, I've always been that way. You know, I wrote three New Jersey books, and people always said, oh, you're going to be the new John Cunningham. And, you know, I was very close to John Cunningham. And I said, no. I've written the three New Jersey books that I want to write. I don't want to just rehash this stuff. And I'm not saying John did that, but I don't want to just, you know, stay here. It's time to move into my fiction. And so I kind of feel the same way now. Now, if the book becomes a number one popular bestseller and somebody says, you know, your next book didn't do well, you got to dig up Joe Grudek and Horace Muller. I don't know, but I'm not thinking in those terms. I'm thinking about the book I'm writing about the police PTSD, and moving forward.
We certainly look forward to your next book, and Mark Diano, the lifelong journalist. You know, we appreciate you coming in not only just to talk about the book, but also we get a better sense of what makes you tick inside, and that's what this program's all about. So we thank you for joining us on Sports Jam.
Doug, thank you very much. It was a great interview. I so appreciate you giving me this amount of time, and I mean that from the bottom of my heart. It's such an honor to be on this station and on this program.
Sports Jam is a WBGO News production. You can check out all the podcasts by going to wbgo.org/sportsjam. Find Sports Jam with Doug Doyle on iTunes. Until our next Sports Jam session, I'll see you at the game.